You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine. This is the 20th lecture and the final lecture in this cycle, given in Dornach on April 9th, 1920. If the education of physicians is to continue in ways that are healing for humankind, certain things that I have attempted to point out in these lectures really must gain ground, specifically the ability to think of the entirety of the healthy or sick human organism in conjunction with outer, non-human forces, substances, and effects. This way of thinking will bridge the gap between the scientific direction in medicine, which increasingly amounts to nothing more than the recognition of diseases, and the effort to create remedies and therapeutic effects. To travel this route successfully, however, we need to acquire an overall view of the human being, a view illumined by spiritual science, starting with the present status of the human being in relationship to the external world. As you know, our connection to the outer world is most highly developed in the interaction between our outer senses and the environment. Our more outer senses, such as the sense of sight, have little to do with internal physical effects. But as soon as we enter the domain of the lower senses, such as smell and taste, we see that our human exterior and our external interaction with the environment have been internalized. Up to a point, human digestion is nothing other than an extension and transformation of sensory activity, until the intestinal processes surrender nutrients to the functions of building up lymph and blood, and even during this transition, the entire process is something of a metamorphosis of sensory activity. The lower down this activity takes place, the more organic its effect. Up to this point, we must recognize the digestive process as an extension of the process of perceiving taste. By giving this fact its due, we can lay the groundwork not only for dietetics as a whole, but also for understanding all the healing factors that are necessary in order to be effective in this particular field. This combination will also allow us to gradually and systematically recognize the damages that can occur here. Suppose you trace the effect of ammonia salts, for example, on the human organism. A believer in modern science will say that ammonia salts, such as ammonium chloride, affect the motoric nervous system of the cardiac muscles. This entire so-called motoric nervous system, however, is a non-entity. Let me read that again. This entire so-called motoric nervous system, however, is a non-entity. As I have already emphasized sufficiently, there is no difference between sensory nerves and motor nerves, so this whole idea is nonsense. The important concern here is something essentially different. As long as the effect of ammonia salts persists, say within the domain extending from the tasting process to the process of blood formation, an internal continuation of the effects of tasting is also present. This continued effect is also an astral body process. In the astral body, it triggers a reaction such as sweat excretion, for example. Being able to grasp this first phase of human digestion as an extension of the tasting process gives you direct insight into both the excretion of sweat and, in a certain way, the excretion of urine. Please consider this situation as follows. When we look at the main events of this phase, we are, essentially, dealing with nutrient absorption as a result of internal secretion of body fluids. This is the main factor. Everything that comes into consideration here can be reduced, more or less, to the dissolving effect body fluids have on food. The opposite of this dissolving effect consists in the activity of the liver and spleen, which is why we had to list liver and spleen activity as belonging to the activity of water or fluids. But in contrast to the dissolving effect that occurs in the first phase of digestion, liver activity has the effect of enclosing and surrounding things, of transforming again what was accomplished in the first part of the process. We can form a fundamental image of what we encounter here by simply looking at two processes side by side. The first is what happens when I throw salt into warm water. The salt dissolves, yielding an image of what happens up to the point when nutrients are absorbed into the lymph and blood vessels. Next to this, I place a couple of rounded drops of mercury, which attempt to create enclosure, to round off, organize, and create forms. This is an image of the process that begins with the absorption of nutrients into the lymph and blood vessels, a process that is governed by the liver and its relationship to the human astral body. We need this type of insight into what is going on, because it encourages us to study how the outer world behaves in the formation of salt and mercury. If we always consider the human being in connection with the outer world, the outer world literally allows us to decipher what needs to be active in the interior of the organism. If we trace the path of ammonia salts further, as they make the transition to blood formation, we find that they alkalize the blood. Further along in their journey, they begin to act from the lower part of the human being and influence the upper region, where they evoke responses. The interesting point, however, is that a complete reversal takes place. The processes are reversed completely. We can characterize this reversal somewhat. Whereas the upper area of the human being initially attempted to perceive within the digestive tract through tasting, now the entire situation reverses. The lower part of the human being tends more toward perception, and the upper part tends more toward what now influences perception. Consequently, while previously a certain reaction set in, which I characterized as proceeding from the astral body, the process is now reversed. The response, that is, what corresponds to the response, goes from below, while what would correspond to the initial action begins from above. Thus, above, the movement of the ciliated epithelia is stimulated, for example, and pulmonary secretion is promoted. The inverse of the original direction is in effect here. Initially, the dissolving process causes movement of the liver, but then the liver's enclosing function induces dissolution, dispersion, and stimulation in the pulmonary functions, which are localized above the liver. Instead of dissolution taking place down below, secretion is induced in upper organs. Within the human organism, this is the route leading from the acquisition of substances via dissolution, via the salt process, to the formative process and on to dispersion, which is comparable to the processes of evaporation and combustion. To provide an image of the phosphorus or sulfur effect, where inorganic substance is ignited, imagine a simmering liquid that is continuously and actively evaporating. Juxtapose this with the droplets of mercury. This is the activity that develops both in the opposite organs, that is, in the lower part of the human being, and in the lungs and related organs in the upper human being. Having understood these internal processes, we can also gain an idea of what can be introduced into them from the outer world. The concepts we acquire are quite far-reaching, extending even to the following activity. If you recall what we said a few days ago, you will realize that tooth development is a very peripheral activity in the human organism, and that, as such, it soon becomes the completely external mineralizing process I described. Please do not misunderstand this statement. I think it has been slightly misunderstood. I said that because tooth formation is such a peripheral process, technical external attempts to repair the teeth through mechanical dental therapy are justified if we are dealing with deterioration of the teeth after the mineralization process has set in, because that is all that can be done from outside. Mechanical treatment, including everything that is done externally to fix the teeth and so on, is all we can do for structures that have become outwardly mineralized. We are justified in having teeth replaced when they become defective, because after a certain point we cannot take care of our own teeth from within. We must take care of our own fluorine-forming process, however, because it has to be there. The entire organism needs it. With respect to the fluorine-forming process in the organism, a substitute must be found for what the teeth do as long as they are still sound. There is a way of creating this substitute, but in doing so, the process of reversal that I have just characterized must be taken into consideration in the right way. What is this entire process of tooth development, if we consider the reality of the situation? It is the mineralizing process moving outward from within. Once the second teeth have all emerged, the goal of pushing the mineralizing process toward the outside has been accomplished. It is then countered by the sexualizing process, which moves inward once again. Tooth formation and the development of sexuality are two opposing processes that work against each other as if in a rhythm. To the same extent that tooth formation is completed, the process of sexualization proceeds in the other direction. But if you look at the situation in this way, you will also realize that a different process in the human being, namely intestinal peristalsis, which is directed inward and toward the rear, is also diametrically opposed to the direction of the tooth-forming process and has a great deal to do with it. These two processes are intimately related. That is, everything belonging to peristalsis is intimately related to everything that brings about tooth formation in the opposite direction. This intestinal movement is intimately associated with the human organism's use of fluorine. We might say that whenever intestinal movement takes place more quickly and intensively than the person's individuality warrants, it has consequences in tooth decay, and especially in everything that fluorine normally ought to be doing in the human organism. Consequently, any dentist who notices that someone's teeth are in very poor condition needs to recommend that the movements of digestion be performed slightly less intensely, which can be accomplished by prescribing either rest, in the purely outer mechanical sense, if the person's occupation permits, or remedies that calm down the digestion, specifically by slightly reducing the intensity of intestinal movement. The regulation of this activity is particularly important and is promoted by limb activity that obeys orderly laws, especially, as I have already pointed out, by activity of the arms and hands and legs and feet and by eurythmy, which imbues movement with soul. It can also be said, however, that if the gymnastic element becomes too strongly physiological, the pendulum swings back in the wrong direction, making it very easy to bring about the opposite effect. This also makes it understandable why activities such as ordinary dancing, to which girls in particular subject themselves, can have a damaging effect on the process of tooth formation. So you really must not ask why girls, who do a lot of dancing, have worse teeth than boys. The point is that this dancing needs to be ensouled and not taken to excess. And with regard to hand activity, simply overdoing the actions involved in knitting and crocheting is enough to produce the opposite effect by using this activity properly. We can see here how a reversal takes place already in the domain of mechanical visible movement. In the first place, a reversal of the process of tooth formation takes place in digestion. But it is also very important for the movement imposed on the digestive process to be transposed into the human movement that serves locomotion, the ability to move in a forward direction. This inversion has aspects that are tremendously important in building up the human being. It means a great deal that human beings are able to walk forward and that their digestion is stimulated to move toward the rear. We can bring about beneficial results by accustoming a person with sluggish digestion to walk backward a lot in gymnastics, which has the effect of promoting digestive activity. From being a mere collection of empirical notes, all these phenomena are transformed into inner insight if we use spiritual science to illuminate the entire constitution of the human being. I would now like to draw your attention to another matter. If we move on to Nux Vomica, we can certainly see that it has a wonderful effect on the human being. What is the basis of this effect? If we simply take advantage of the appropriate opportunity to study Nux Vomica, we will gain inner insight into it. If you simply study Nux Vomica, that's N-U-X and then V-O-M-I-C-A, Nux or Nux Vomica, in people with hangovers, you will see what kind of an effect it has there, and this makes it easier to gain an overview of all of its other effects. In a hangover, there is a real reversal of all of human organic activity. A hangover is an extension of the process that takes place primarily in the first phase of digestive activity. After overindulgence in wine, beer, or champagne, a hangover sets in, when what occurs up to the point where substances are absorbed into the lymph and blood-forming processes continues on into these processes themselves. Then the domain of the human organism, whose real task is to dissolve substances, is transformed into a sensory organ of a sort. Instead of directing the major part of their sensory activity toward the outer world, instead of entering into communication with the outer world and encountering the earth and its processes, people who are hung over condemn themselves to perceive internally, because what is now inside them has become very, very similar to the earth's external activity. They begin to sense the earth's rotation, and the bed begins to spin. An earthly activity of a sort, an internal outer world, is present beyond their intestinal activity, in the activity of lymph and blood formation. These people have transformed themselves into an internal outer world, and have horrible perceptions of processes that do not bother them at all when perceived externally. The interior of the human being is not suited to become an earth. On the contrary, it is meant to withdraw from the earth. Now, however, these people create a real earth inside themselves. It would be more appropriate to shift this earth to the outside and surround it by sensory perceivers who could view it externally. But instead, these people are forced to perceive it with the outer portion of the human interior. Until a strong natural healing process sets in, which it usually does, Nux Vomica counteracts the symptoms that arise by suppressing sensitivity to this outer thing that has been internalized. At the same time, this suppression does not disturb the internally located outer process. This relates to one of Naksvamaka's healing effects, which is to weaken the extension of the metamorphosed process of taste so that it no longer disrupts what is located beyond it. This weakening brings about a cure of sorts. Now assume that the opposite situation is present. The extended tasting process, that is, the dissolving process, is impaired rather than enhanced, so that it does not go far enough. Let us assume that this situation exists. The interior proves to be too weak to adequately dissolve what is taken in from the outer world, and involve it in the salt-forming process. This first phase of digestion is working the way we want it to when we administer Naksvamaka, but it is doing so naturally through a different process to which the inadequately dissolved substances attempt to adapt. They cannot find the way out. They cannot cross the boundary between the process of tasting and digesting on the one hand and the process of blood formation on the other. Consequently, they look for a way out in the opposite direction, which gives rise to all the symptoms that can be alleviated simply by promoting the dissolving process that Naksvamaka suppresses. Everything that is looking for the wrong way out can be counteracted with thuja, thuja. We have just deduced the polarity between Naksvamaka and thuja from the constitution of the human being, which also demonstrates that we always need to look at the overall organization of the human being, because it is important not to underestimate the polarities present there. The functions that drive the activity in the lower part of the human being up toward the upper part are all intensified during sleep. We must be very careful about how we attempt to characterize sleep. While it is indeed true that sleep is one of the best remedies, this is true only when sleep lasts exactly long enough to meet the needs of the human individuality in question, neither longer nor shorter. Sleeping too long makes a person sick, because it causes excessive percolation through the boundary I have just described. Too much moves from the first phase of digestion over into the lymph and blood-forming process. We are constantly exposed to this danger, because the lower part of the human organism is always asleep, and therefore continually subjects us to the sickening of the blood. We carry the antidote around within us, however, although this antidote is of course attuned only to the normal process that constantly attempts to sicken us through sleep, the process that is balanced out by the iron content of the blood. Iron is the metal that is most important to human beings. It works inside us, equalizing any excess that moves from one process into the other. What I have just said explains both the diseases that result from iron deficiency in the blood and the fact that iron, if it is administered in a potency high enough to be related to the homeopathizing process that is evoked each time by the upper part of the human being, can always help the organism overcome the intrinsic disruptive processes that work from below upward. As you have already seen, human processes substitute for the other main metal processes relevant to the human being. In this context, I would like to briefly summarize what arises out of the whole spirit of my lectures here. Today we have once again pointed to lymph and blood formation in the human being. This process has a relationship to copper, in that it is the polar opposite of copper's mineralizing tendency. We would like to make it clear to ourselves that this activity still belongs to the lower region of the human being, specifically to the uppermost portion of this lower organism, and that its relationship to copper, therefore, tends very strongly in the direction of the earth's copper-forming force, since everything related to the lower part of the human being is related to earthly processes. In working with copper, the golden rule is generally to use it in low potencies, not in doses large enough to be harmful to humans, of course, but in proportions that are all still fairly similar to its naturally occurring concentrations in the earth. Just as the inner activity of lymph and blood formation is related to copper, everything standing at the transition between the outer digestive process and the internal digestive process of lymph and blood formation is related to the liver, and especially to mercury. It relates to mercury in the same way that the other process relates to copper, with the reservation that mercury's rounding, balancing aspect already links it somewhat to the interaction between these two processes. But the processes that human beings must develop so that not too much gets into the blood, the processes that nux vomica induces and thuja suppresses, are regulated by the action of silver. At this point, the field is open to investigate outer nature with these constituents in mind, and to see nature as a dismembered human being, as it were. In this way, we put the human being, whether well or ill, entirely into the context of the environment to which we are so closely related through the lower parts of the human organism. What rises into our upper parts from below, through the copper-related process, is regulated and balanced out by the opposition of iron. This demonstrates that human beings need iron. We always need an excess of iron processes, or chemically speaking, iron. All the other metals are present in human beings in the form of processes. In a certain respect, the human being is a sevenfold metal, but only iron is present as such, while the other metals are present only in the form of processes. Just as everything that works together with lymph and blood formation in our organs is related to copper, everything that moves outward from the lungs, opening up in the larynx and so forth, is related to iron. Similarly, the portions of the brain that serve internal functions, that are more similar to the brain's digestive activity, and therefore correspond to the process of transition between the intestines and the lymph and blood vessels, are related to the tin-forming process, which works to ensole and regulate the digestive process in the area I have just described. In contrast, nerve fibers and related structures that represent the extension of the senses in the upper region of the human being are related to lead, which in turn corresponds to the processes of sweat and urine excretion. I might say that these things illuminate the human being and simultaneously point to how we can extract therapeutic benefits from the opposite effects in the substances surrounding us. We must recognize the need for spiritual science to point out how so-called psychiatric disorders are seated in the organs in many respects, and how organic diseases are very strongly related to effects of soul and spirit. This is a difficult chapter. On the one hand, materialism proceeds purely on the basis of mechanics or chemistry in dealing with so-called physical illnesses, treating the human being more or less like a mechanical device. On the other hand, it has reached the point of being unable to provide more than a mere description of psychological symptoms in so-called psychiatric disorders, because it has lost the ability to see the connection between the soul's spirit and the physical body. The intimate connection between these two aspects becomes evident when we investigate the interplay between psychological and bodily states of health in a concrete way. What promotes psychiatric illness? In the first stages of an illness, pain and other subjective symptoms appear. These symptoms are most apparent in acute illnesses and are transformed in chronic illnesses. They constitute the response of a person's soul and spirit to any type of organ damage, the withdrawal of soul and spirit from the organs in question. Pain is simply the withdrawal of the eye and astral body from the physical and etheric bodies. Pain may also be linked to a withdrawal of the etheric body, but the essence of the sensation of pain lies in the astral body and the eye. As a rule, the eye is still strong enough to perceive the entire subjective conscious process that is the opposite and counterpart of the one taking place in the physical organ. As the illness becomes chronic, this conscious process gradually withdraws from the eye. As a consequence, what is happening on the level of the soul is now restricted to the astral body. The eye no longer participates in what the astral body and etheric body are suffering. A disease of the organs moves on to become chronic. Acute illness becomes chronic. This is a question of conscious symptoms on the soul level, which retreat. If we want to pursue symptomatology, we must study the individual in greater depth. Instead of asking how someone feels or where it hurts, we must ask whether he sleeps well or badly, or whether or not she feels like working. What we regard as symptoms in chronic illnesses must extend over longer periods of time and have more to do with the entire process of a person's development, while immediate subjective sensations can be considered symptoms in cases of acute illness. When it comes to chronic illness, we must look more at the person's biography than at immediate symptoms. Ordinary physical chronic illness occurs when the whole process can be contained within the organ in such a way that the astral body and etheric body still participate properly in the organ's activity, sending as much as is needed into it. If the patient's constitution permits him or her to tolerate the astral body's disordered effect by way of the etheric body on the organ in question, it will also permit the patient to take the astral body's abnormal connection to the liver, for instance, beyond a certain critical point, so that the liver no longer notices that the astral body fails to work into it in the right way. In this case, I would say that the liver recovers, but becomes accustomed to the disordered effect of the astral body. If this goes on long enough, it will make its way into the soul in the reverse direction. Something the liver ought to pull into the physical body is pushed into the soul instead, resulting in depression. In a certain respect, then, the seeds of so-called mental illness are sown by overcoming chronic illnesses to the point of tolerating an abnormal connection to the astral body. Someday, when these matters are generally studied in this way, we will go beyond merely describing the pathology of mental illnesses. There is a lot of talk today about irregularities in processes of ideation or will activity. But as long as we do not know how the curious interaction of the liver, spleen, and other abdominal organs supports what ultimately appears in its highest form on the soul level as human will, we will not be able to find the physical counterparts of the pathological symptoms we describe. Especially in so-called psychiatric disorders, it should occur to us to implement physical methods of treatment. It may seem contradictory that spiritual science would lead, on the one hand, to physical treatment in so-called psychiatric disorders, while on the other, pointing to the soul's role in recovery from physical ailments. But this is related to the great contrast between the upper and lower parts of the human being. It is also related to the reversal that occurs when sensory activity, introduced from outside, becomes inner sensory activity, which is the case in the extension of the tasting process, or when something that is present in the interior discharges outwardly in ciliary movement, or the potential for ciliary movement. If understood correctly, this can lead to a certain goal. There's a footnote, and I believe it's from Anthroposophy of Fragment by Rudolf Steiner. Quote, through the sense of taste, we penetrate one stage deeper into outer substantiality, then through the sense of smell. In smelling, the substance itself approaches us and discloses its particular character. In tasting, it is the substance's effect on us that is perceived. The difference between them is best felt by visualizing how, in the sense of smell, a gas-like substance approaches us in a finished state, so that we can perceive it as it is, while in the sense of taste, we use our own fluid to dissolve the substance, that is, we cause a change in it, in order to delve into peculiarities of this substance that it does not reveal to us on its own. This means that the sense of smell is suited to perceiving the outside of the material element, while the sense of taste, already to some extent, goes inside material things. For the inside of an object to be disclosed, we must change its outside. Close quote from Rudolf Steiner, Anthroposophy of Fragment, Anthroposophic Press, Hudson, New York, 1996, page 91. End of footnote. Now, I have tried to expose you to quite a lot in these 20 lectures. When I was preparing them and getting an overview of everything that would be relevant, I realized that giving these lectures would be difficult. Where should we begin? If we began with elementary subjects, we would not get very far in 20 lectures, because we would have time only to point out the route that needs to be taken. But if we began upstairs, as it were, and introduced all sorts of occult facts, it would not be easy to bridge the gap to modern medicine in a certain direction, and even more time would be required. Wherever we observe the extensive damage done by materialism today, we also see the need to counteract this damage from the other direction. Please understand what I am saying as a friendly comment, rather than as taking sides in any particular direction. It is not my intention to be partisan in any way. I simply want to present the facts objectively. One thing, however, may and must be said. If we survey modern allopathic medicine, we invariably find that it tends to evaluate patients with a view to the concomitant phenomena described by the bacterial theory of infection. This diverts our attention to a secondary issue. As a mere aid to recognition, the natural history of bacilli would be extremely useful. We can, indeed, learn a lot from the type of bacillus that is present, because a certain type always appears under the influence of a very specific primary cause. There is always plenty of opportunity to see this connection. There is a tendency to mistake a secondary factor for the primary cause, as when, for example, we look at the extent to which bacilli affect human organs, instead of the extent to which the human organism can become a habitat for bacilli. Such a tendency appears not only in allopathic medical theories concerning bacteria, but also in that whole way of thinking. Consequently, this tendency causes damage that I need not elucidate, since many of you have noticed it yourselves. You see, homeopathic medicine has at least certain advantages in that it always aims at the human being as a whole, keeps an image of the overall effect in mind, and attempts to build a bridge to the discovery of remedies. But we also cannot always be satisfied when we scrutinize homeopathic medicine because of another idiosyncrasy of homeopathic medical literature. Please forgive me for saying this, but if you look at this literature, especially the therapeutic literature, it can almost drive you to despair, because you find the remedies listed one after the other, and each one is always supposed to help a whole army of illnesses. It is never easy to find anything specific. Everything is helpful for so many different conditions. I know that this is how things have to be, at least for the present, but it simply leads us astray. We can resist being led astray only by proceeding in the way that has been indicated here, at least on an elementary level. This is why I chose an elementary content for these lectures, instead of beginning with the occult. The situation can be improved only when this method of studying human and non-human nature enables us to move on to restricting the usage indications of remedies to delineating remedies. This is not possible unless, in addition to studying a remedy's effect on a person who is healthy or ill, we also gradually attempt to see the entire cosmos as a unity. For example, we must study the human being by tracing the entire antimonizing process, as I pointed out in one instance yesterday. We must attempt to see what antimony does outside the human being, in connection with what it can accomplish inside the human being. This view delineates very specific domains in the outer world, which then have connections to the human being. As I said before, such issues led me to emphasize elementary content in these 20 lectures. Of course, naturopathy, natureopathy, maybe, because it serves the instinct to reconnect human beings to their own healing processes in a natural way, makes it necessary to point out the true basis of these intrinsic healing forces, namely, the interaction between earthly and supra-earthly factors. For this reason, naturopathy is dependent on not becoming too strongly involved in materialism. Today it really is possible to see how all the different partisan directions are tending toward materialism, which in a certain sense is common to all of them. Thus the important thing is to spiritualize this entire field. However, today's world is very opposed to any such effort. The antidote to materialism will also need to appear from the side of experts and professionals, because what we are attempting here, although it may be in its very beginning stages, must not be misinterpreted as fostering dilettantism. This prejudiced view of what we are doing already exists, and it is very damaging. That is why I want to emphasize how important it is for any of you who understand that we are attempting to work scientifically to contribute to combating this prejudice. At present, people take into account and enlist the help of everything that modern science has to offer, but they are unwilling to see what we are really attempting to accomplish. I would like to mention one thing here in conclusion, just as an example. Such instances occur repeatedly. You see, it is possible to properly explain eurythmy's significance for the human constitution only to a physician. The reason this building, the first Gertianum in Dornach, stands here can be explained only to a physician who is able to understand how the entire human organism turns first inward and then outward again, as we have discussed in these lectures. Today what we say must be based on what completely opposes lay materialism and outmoded traditional schools of thought. We must also consider something that I believe needs to be combated on a professional level, otherwise such blatant examples will simply proliferate. You see, our kind Mr. M., who left yesterday, attempted to put his goodwill into action by writing an article about the Dornach building and eurythmy for a Zurich newspaper. He received this response. Quote, "Dear sir, it is beyond comprehension that the theosophical Anthroposophium, with its tasteless mockery of the countryside, can lay claim to Goethe's name. We have seen more than enough examples of eurythmy here. Thanks for sending the material. H. Trog, editor." Close quote. Now, you see this curious opposition to the spiritual element that is intended to come into the world. This is what we encounter today, and the decadent substance of such materialistic troughs force us to pay some attention to them as they assault our noses with their contaminating stench. Footnote: there is a play on words here. Trog, the name of the editor, means trough, presumably the kind used for feeding farm animals. Close quote. End of footnote. This is what I wanted to say in concluding this cycle of lectures, because it helps me to emphasize my request that you consider this cycle to be only a beginning. As I said to myself as I prepared, it was difficult to begin, owing to reasons I have already enumerated. But now that we are at the end, I must say that it is even more difficult to stop. Not to say what I would also have said is truly more painful. I beg you to consider all this in your assessment of what this introduction was able to provide. I hope that you and others will understand that I am speaking out of truly objective, not merely subjective, heartfelt feelings, when I now say to you, whose attendance here has demonstrated your great interest in this beginning, quote, until we meet again on a similar occasion, close quote. Dr. Steiner concluded, following a participant's expression of thanks, my dear friends, I have chosen this avenue as the only way that spiritual science will be of use to the art of healing. In future, too, you will find that for readily understandable reasons, I will adhere to the method I have used up to now. I want the necessary interaction of spiritual science and healing to remain a matter between myself and the healers. I myself, of course, never have intervened and never want to intervene in the practice of healing. This is left up to practicing physicians. Everything that needs the stimulus of spiritual science should exist on the basis of the give and take between spiritual science and physicians themselves. Any prejudice that might be added to whatever prejudice already exists can be more easily prevented by making it impossible for people to say that I am a charlatan who is actively involved in curing people. This is something I have always attempted to avoid. Thank you very much. The end of Lecture 20 and the end of the cycle by Rudolf Steiner, Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine, given in 1920 in Dornach.